This podcast is for investment professionals only. The value of investments and the income from them may go down as well as up, and investors may not get back the amounts originally invested. Past performance is not a guide to future performance. The information is not an offer, solicitation, or recommendation of any funds, services, or products, or to adopt any investment strategy.
Hello, just a quick note. In this show, we use the acronym ADR, which stands for American Depositary Receipt. It's a form of equity security that's created specifically to simplify foreign investing for American investors. An ADR is issued by an American bank or broker. It represents one or more shares of foreign company stock held by that bank in the home stock market of the foreign company. Enjoy the show.
Good day, everyone, and welcome to the U.S. Lens. I'm Ron Insana, Senior Advisor to Schroders North America. The Chinese stock market has underperformed the rest of the world so far this year, and by a wide margin. A return of the coronavirus, slower than expected economic growth, a crackdown on certain industries and individuals have all combined to keep Shanghai shares on the defensive. Coupled with President Xi's drive toward common prosperity, can China rebound, or are Chinese markets in danger of losing their luster? Joining me now to address those questions is Robin Parbrook. He is fund manager of Asian equities at Schroders. Robin, good to have you. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, Ron, and very good to be here. Obviously, a big question, that one. Lots of different angles we could look at it from. But maybe if I take the first thing, why are the markets really down so much? And it's not to do with economic growth numbers, which have been slightly disappointing, not really to do with COVID numbers either in China. It's all about regulation. And you can see that because the bulk of the falls came in the last 2 to 3 months when China really started talking about how it wanted the education or the sector to operate. And ultimately, it has turned the bulk of the tutoring education sector in China into a non-profit sector. And that then gave everyone a bit of a wake-up call about regulatory risks in China. And then you've had the series of announcements, which is really a combination of a whole set of policies that's been building up for some time. And if anyone had, if we'd looked at, maybe we should have all been more aware of it looking at President Xi's speeches over the last 3 or 4 years, there's been a lot of talk about common prosperity, leveling up, social mobility, financialization risks, dual circulation policy. By that we mean China becoming more self-sufficient in key strategic industries. So there's actually been a big policy reset coming on, where I think, you know, the penny only really dropped really come sort of May, June time this year. I think for us as investors, we all knew the direction of travel in China about rising regulatory risks, but how quickly they've moved to regulate many key sectors in China. So this is obviously in particular the internet sector, which is the one for most American investors, the one that gets the focus, because obviously many of the stocks are US listed, but it's also applied to the insurance sector, healthcare sector, and real estate sector. So it's quite all encompassing, and it is a big structural re-looking at the market. And so if you were looking at the market, there's a good reason why it's fallen if you've started regulating, you know, sectors that are a big chunk of your index.
Let me ask about that. In fact, the index, you know, the MSCI China index is down 32% peak to trough. It bounced a little bit last week and has been wavering of late. Is this the worst that we're going to see in the performance of Chinese shares and related shares, or is there still more regulatory and other risk in front of us?
So it's obviously hard to say because we're in a completely fluid situation because we don't know what the next announcements are going to be. I think the way you need to look at this is you've probably seen the big fall. And remember, the markets from the top to the bottom, from the highs in February, March, that was pretty frothy highs where you were getting bubble-like valuations, particularly in the internet and some of the biotech sectors. So those, even if we hadn't had the regulator announcements, those sectors looked very vulnerable to a correction. However, having said that, obviously we've seen a big correction. So things like stocks like Alibaba have, you know, close to half from their highs. So the bulk of the initial falls are probably over. The big regulatory shock has come. I think people are now aware that China, and I've been saying this for some time, you cannot compare Alibaba with Amazon. You cannot compare Tencent with Facebook because, sure, these are domestic Chinese companies operating in a completely different environment from US peers, it'd be like comparing China Construction Bank with JP Morgan. We would never do that. So why would you do it for those stocks? So going back to the initial question, the falls are justified in my view, because we have seen a much more draconian and harsher regulatory environment than we expected. We're probably through the worst, but if you're looking for a rebound, we think any rebound is likely to be muted, and we are likely to see further announcements ongoing, particularly in those sectors. You know, read what President Xi and the CCP policy say. They want to get real estate prices down. They want to get healthcare costs down. Most stocks in China are considered, you know, you're not necessarily state-owned enterprises, but you are beholden to the state, so you will be working for the common goal. So we are going to see more moves and regulatory noise around it, which will, I think, limit any rebound in markets and leaves us quite cautious in those sectors, which are clearly part of the policy goals towards common prosperity, getting Gini coefficients down, et cetera, et cetera.
Let me ask you about common prosperity. I mean, we talk about income inequality here in the United States, and we talk about in other parts of the world as well, the Western world. When President Xi references common prosperity, what exactly does he mean?
Yeah, it's a catch-hold phrase for quite a different aspects of things. But the two principal factors he's looking at is obviously China's demographic time bomb. So China relaxed its one-child policy a couple of years ago, but the birth rates kept falling, maybe partly due to COVID worries, but I don't think it is. The birth rate's falling because young people in China don't want to have kids because of all the pressures on tutoring, healthcare costs. Because remember, if you're a married couple in China at childbearing age, you're probably looking after four parents and potential, whatever the number would be, 16 grandparents, because you know, the one-child policy has been ongoing for such a long time. So, you know, your liabilities you're looking at are discouraging you from having children. So there's that side, but also the side of rising Gini coefficients, the general groundswell feeling, particularly amongst middle-class urban Chinese, that the gains of economic growth are being garnered by a very few. So much of the same issues that we have in the West, and you look at the numbers in China on social mobility and, you know, rising Gini coefficients, the middle class in China are exactly right to feel that way. So, you know, it's a policy shift in China that you would, I think, for many of us in the West would be sympathetic to. It's just the way China goes about doing it. Yep. Is a very draconian, non-sort of liberal Western way of doing things. But we should never impose our liberal Western mindsets when we're investing in China. You have to, you know, that is why you have higher equity risk premiums. And the risks in China, as they are in all emerging markets, you know, not just China, you apply this to India, Brazil, Russia, are higher than you would have in a country that operates in a much more liberal, standard capitalist way. But that's, you know, our mindset versus a different mindset.
Yeah, let me focus in a little bit about common prosperity, which, again, you define as being somewhat different than income inequality in the West. I mean, the question is, when you look at a Jack Ma who has spoken out and then been sidelined, or you look at other prominent, wealthy Chinese individuals, effectively, is there anyone in China now who wants to be a billionaire, given this regulatory framework that you just described?
I think many Chinese would want to be a billionaire, but you keep your mouth shut when you do it, Ron. So what you don't want to do is become too big for your boots, if that wants to put that phrase. So you can be a quiet billionaire, and then obviously you'd be expected to give lots of money to, you know, charitable donations and do all the right things. So I think you can be prosperous in China, but I guess, I don't know how this works for a US audience, but I was saying this for a UK audience the other day. So the city I was originally born in is Glasgow on the west coast of Scotland. It's a poor city, and there you flash your cash. So you if you make some money, you go and buy a Mercedes with lots of bells and whistles. The city I now live in Scotland is Edinburgh. There, the one thing you don't do is flash your cash. You drive around in a beaten up old Land Rover and stay very humble, because it's considered, you know, a very different environment. And I think that's what they want in China. You can be a quiet billionaire and a good billionaire, but, you know, the days of, you know, rubbing everyone else's nose in it and, you know, making a song and dance about how rich you are have gone. So that's what they don't want. So it's that kind of policy reset. And it goes back to the common prosperity. It is about making people feel happier, partly so they have more children, but also that you remove you try and make society more harmonious, you remove the resentment in society, you know, which we see in the West. So it's those kind of policies that I think is as much about, you know, improving demographics.
Yeah, we also see it in China, though, with the Lie Flat movement, right? There are a lot of young kids who are rejecting materialism and rejecting the, you know, what we used to call, you know, kind of climbing the corporate ladder, and have begun to really walk away from being innovators of the future.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's partly the common prosperity. I think President Xi hates the lying flat movement, so hence why any reference to it on the various chat forums in China is immediately outlawed. But it's almost like a quasi, as you say, almost hippie movement where, you know, the stress of society and the pressure of being a single child with so much expected from you, from your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents, it's just so horrific that it's just to drop out and play your guitar and lie on the sofa and play computer games. But of course, you're not allowed to play computer games anymore because they've been banned.
On Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, you're listening to the Investor Download.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. And this is something that's obviously become increasingly concerning for Western investors who have seen not just the shares of some of their most recognizable investments in China decline, as you say, as much as 50%. But the American depositary receipts here are one way to play China. And it's not been particularly alluring for U.S. investors. Is there another way to access China that might give an investor a reasonable chance at a return against the regulatory and demographic and economic framework that you described?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different ways to invest in China. There always has been. You can buy Western companies with high exposure to China, like Louis Vuitton or Nike, Adidas. They all have very significant parts of their business and their growth parts of their business in China. Going back to the ADR specifically, we are expecting nearly all ADRs to relist back in China. The one thing the U.S. financial authorities and Chinese authorities appear to agree on is they don't want VIE, ADR, China-listed stocks in America, and China doesn't want them there either. So
let me just
stop
you for
1 second. Disorderly.
That VIE, that's a variable interest entity, is that right? Can you describe what that is relative to a typical listing of an American stock in America?
Yeah, I mean, so a VIE is a structure whereby you can access a revenue stream and a profit stream from a Chinese listed company where you're normally not allowed to own that company because it's restricted to foreign investors. So this would be media companies in particular, hence, you know, why most Chinese internet stocks, because they're defined as media stocks, and foreign investors aren't meant to own that. So they set up a series of companies, normally via Cayman, and you end up owning a Cayman-listed company that basically just has the right to the profits of the underlying assets of the original Chinese-listed company. So a VIE, in theory, doesn't actually own those assets. It just has a rights into perpetuity to the revenues and profits from those assets.
Kind of like a tracking stock?
And yeah, but it's actually, obviously, you don't actually own the assets. So, yes, yeah, so I suppose that would be like a tracking stock, Ron. But I mean, the structure's always been a slightly grey area. The key is that it didn't matter so much when US and China were closer, but the risks are now that, you know, China could unwind those disorderly and you have no recourse back to the assets. So the best thing that can happen is the ADRs relist back in Hong Kong and you get your China exposure via Hong Kong listed stocks or via A-share stocks on the Shenzhen or Shanghai stock exchanges. And that's the best way probably to get your China exposure. Or you buy, you know, multinational companies with businesses in China, which could also be things like Schindler or Kone, businesses, you know, like that. So there's lots of different ways to invest in China. The key is probably you want to try and invest where you're minimizing your regulatory risks. But for the audience here, don't go away, you know, panicking that we think all the ADRs are going to be disorderly listed. That's not what we expect. We expect over time, most ADRs will have their primary listing back in Hong Kong, which is effectively what's happening at the moment anyway.
All right, so against the backdrop that we've just discussed, the so-called the knock-on effects throughout the region in Asia, given the uncertainties around China, what does the rest of that part of the world look like from an investment perspective?
Yeah, so there's a big debate we're having internally. So obviously, as we've touched on earlier, Ron, there's a big reset in China. This is something structural. It's not cyclical. It's not noise. It does mean you want to rethink how much money you might want to have in China. When you turn your most vibrant part of the economy, so your internet stocks and some of your healthcare names, into quasi-state-owned enterprises, they do become less interesting. So the initial reaction has been that you will see money shifting to other markets in the region. So India, being the other sort of large market, large population, is the obvious place where we have seen a little bit of money drifting back into. The Indian markets performed relatively well, despite India obviously having a complete disaster with COVID. So you know, that's what the initial reaction. The bigger one, which we don't really know, is whether you start seeing investors reviewing whether they need to have so much money in China, Asia generally, or emerging markets, because China's obviously by far and away the largest market in our universes. So they start reducing their exposure to Asia and emerging markets more generally. We haven't seen that. I'm not anticipating that at the moment, but we are anticipating you will see money looking to diversify out of China, possibly into India, maybe some of the smaller ASEAN markets, maybe back to Korea and Taiwan, because they're the more liquid markets in the region.
Yeah, let me ask you that as a final question. The question here in the West has always been, can you afford not to be in China? The question today is, can you afford to be in China?
Yeah, I mean, it's different. You're always going to be in China when you're investing, because you're assuming you're buying large multinational companies, they're going to have exposure in China. So you can't ignore China, because it will affect Apple, it will affect Nike, it will affect Schindler Kone, and there's lots of Chinese companies wanting to compete with all of those companies, obviously, as we know. So you can't ignore China. The question is, as an asset class, do you need to have a big strategic asset allocation to Chinese equities? And I think that's the more, you know, what we've had now is, you know, I still think you should have exposure to China. There's some fantastic companies outside in China that are broadly unaffected by the regulatory risks of the consumer companies, some of the export companies, some of the tech companies. They aren't the focus of what's happening now. So there's plenty of stocks I can have in my funds that still have exposure to China. But for a global investor, an investor sitting in the States, do you need to have a big strategic asset allocation to Chinese companies? Probably not, because the big Chinese companies, the banks, insurers, you know, possibly some the internet companies, you know, aren't particularly interesting when you've got your, you know, common prosperity, dual circulation policies, and a very interventionist government. That, you know, the chance of, you know, I was probably saying to a client the other day, you know, the beta from China is probably relatively less now. So buying an index fund in China doesn't make much sense. However, if you look at active fund managers, and not just, I'm not trying to promote active fund management particularly, but active fund managers in China have done very well. There's lots of opportunity to make alpha because the market's super inefficient. So, you know, I would look at it that kind of way, that you want to buy a really good active fund, but don't go overboard in how much you want to asset allocate there, because the risks, which were always there, but have now risen materially on the regulatory side.
All right, Robin, a pleasure. Thanks for being with us today. I do appreciate it. Robin Parbrook is fund manager of Asian equities at Schroders, joining us in today's U.S. Lens. Thanks for joining us for this conversation. We'll talk to you again relatively soon.
Well, that was the show. We very much hope you enjoyed it. If you want to find out more, check out our website, schroders.com/theinvestor download. You can also get in contact with us about anything in the show or ideas for future shows at schroderspodcast@schroders.com. Please remember to subscribe to us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a review. We're now doing one show a week, which will be available every Thursday from 5 p.m. UK time. Thanks very much for listening, but above all, keep safe and go well. Cheers.